Good morning. Please be seated. Thank you. We are here in the matter of Woods versus King Row. Are the parties ready to proceed?
Yes, we are.
Very well. Case number 63190. Mr. Carter?
Yes.
May it please the court, we're here this morning because the district court dismissed my pro se client's complaint below on the narrowest of possible grounds. The grounds that the statute of limitations on his civil rights claim, which was 1 year, had run before the filing of the state law complaint. This was an erroneous decision for a few reasons. First and foremost, it did not take into account that my client stated other claims apart from a civil rights anti-discrimination claim. And second, the court erroneously calculated the statute of limitations because as a matter of Nevada law and equity, the statute of limitations on the civil rights claim should have been told. Now, I want to talk about those substantive points in just a moment, but first I think it's important that we look at the standard of review in this case because that's key to where the lower court's error came in this decision. Of course, this is a de novo review because it's a motion to dismiss. Now, for a motion to dismiss, however, that is a particularly broad standard because a motion to dismiss should not be granted unless the complaint appears beyond a doubt that it could prove no set of facts which, if true, would entitle the plaintiff to relief. And that's this court's decision in DeBoer and in 2012 and on back, which is a particularly broad standard. It means that the court was obligated to look at the entire complaint as it was filed by my client and to determine whether there was any possible basis for there to be a claim that could go forward in front of that court. However, what we have here is an even broader standard that the district court failed to follow, and that's because in the lower court, my client was not represented by counsel. He was incarcerated. He was not an attorney. And he, frankly, did not understand several of the terms of art that a lawyer would. He didn't understand many of the ways to frame a complaint so that it could escape a motion to dismiss.
Do we have cases that say we indulge a more generous or forgiving standard of review when a person is proceeding pro se, or more narrowly when pro se and incarcerated?
Well, Your Honor, the Nevada Supreme Court, no, does not have one that explicitly says that that's published. I would refer the court to its unpublished order in Milam versus Stealth Holdings, LLC, and specifically Justice Hardesty's opinion in that case, where Justice Hardesty adopted the Ninth Circuit standard for dealing with pro se litigants. And the Ninth Circuit, specifically the case that was cited by Milam, was Waters versus Young. And that was a case where a pro se litigant had a motion for directed verdict granted against him at the trial. And the Ninth Circuit ended up reversing that decision, saying that if you're going to grant a motion like that against a pro se litigant, you have to let them know what's going on. And you have to tell them what they need to do, or offer proof that they need to make to escape that motion, and help them out and make sure that pro se litigants aren't tripped up by procedural technicalities. Now, that's the case that was specifically cited in Milam. The Ninth Circuit does actually have a very broad body of case law on this, going to Wilhelm versus...
Well, and a lot of jurisdictions do it by rule as well. Like, if you're going to make a motion for summary judgment and you're against a pro se, you need to explain that, you know, what you need to do. But to do it judicially, it's something we'd have to look at. Do you need us to do that in this case for your client to win? It seems to me, you mentioned your first point is that he or she had other claims that were asserted beyond the discrimination and housing claim. Can you tell me about those other claims?
Absolutely, Justice Pickering. The other claims were listed in the December 12th, 2012 complaint as, I believe they were framed as extreme and outrageous conduct and intimidation.
So intentional infliction?
Yes, Your Honor, exactly. Intentional infliction of emotional distress. And if you look in the record specifically at Joint Appendix, pages 8 and 9, and then page 38, all of the allegations for intentional infliction of emotional distress claim are well laid out. Now, granted, he doesn't use a lot of the terms of art that I would have used as a lawyer had I been drafting the complaint.
But maybe that's preferable, actually.
Well, Your Honor, obviously, I think you touch on a key point, that the Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure 8 requires a very short and plain statement of the facts. And I think that when he filed his declaration in the lower court at JA 38, I think it gave much more than a short and plain statement of the facts. And all of that was before the district court. And I think as your question was getting at, Justice Pickering, that's a very important point, because an intentional infliction of emotional distress claim has at least a two-year statute of limitations. And we know here from the declaration that was filed, the accrual of the cause of action was in February 16th of 2011. And my client's state law complaint was filed in December 12th of 2012. That's less than 2 years, Your Honor. So absolutely we can get to a reversal on that point. Now, on the intimidation claim, I do want to talk about that a little bit.
What is that claim legally? What is an intimidation?
Well, legally it was treated by the parties as a defamation claim, Your Honor. It was not, I'll be the first to admit to you that it was not pled very well, but it was understood by all the parties below in front of Judge Baird to be a defamation claim. If the court goes back and the court looks at the pleadings that were before Judge Baird, they will see that there was a lot of discussion about why this wasn't defamation, why it wasn't published to a third person, and we talk about whether those were properly alleged, and we can talk about that here today too. But the point was, that was before the court, and the court never put that in the order. It was never even considered, like the IIED. We go to the court's order, which is at JA 111 and 112. It's not even mentioned. And again, defamation would have a two-year statute of limitations. This should be a claim that would be properly litigated before the district court as of December 2012. Now, apart from those claims, which I think you're right, Your Honor, I think they absolutely would mandate reversal independent of
any. Because you don't need the tolling in order to get those claims, assuming the complaint adequately adumbrated them.
That's correct, Your Honor. However, I do want to put up a fight for the civil rights claim as well.
Yes.
Because I think the civil rights claim is important, and I think the facts here are very important.
What legal doctrine are you invoking to make that claim work? Because the one-year statute had run.
Right. Well, there's two legal doctrines that we're making, Your Honor. One is equitable tolling, and one is the statute, Nevada Revised Statutes 11.500. I'll talk about equitable tolling first because I think that's a little bit more of a weighty argument. And that goes back all the way to this court's decision in Copeland versus Desert Inn Hotel in 1983. And what this court said in that decision was that the concept of equitable tolling is especially important in the context of civil rights and anti-discrimination statutes. Now, the statute in mind in the Copeland case was, I believe, a disability statute. It was an employment litigation thing. But it's the same sort of statute as the public accommodation statute for Nevada, because it is specifically an anti-discrimination statute. And when I'm talking about the statute in this case, of course, I'm referring to Nevada Revised Statutes 651. And this court also said, the State Department of Taxation versus Masco, that equitable tolling operates to suspend the running of a statute of limitation when the only bar to a timely filed claim is a procedural technicality. Here's the procedural technicality here, Your Honor. My client was pro se, again, he was incarcerated. He didn't understand, frankly, the difference between state and federal court, and he didn't understand the different kinds of complaints that one can file in state and federal court. This was originally filed in June of 2011 in federal court as a 1983 action, 42 U.S.C. 1983. And I think most of us know that you can't have a 1983 action without a state actor. This isn't a state actor. This is a private civil dispute. Of course, my client didn't understand that. Now,
Doesn't that go to Justice Pickering's initial question, and that is, to what extent do we expand the rules to accommodate a pro for a litigant who doesn't know. I think we all share the concern for letting everyone have their day in court, but recognizing the chaos that would ensue if we allowed this type of slippery slope, so to speak. I'm just not comfortable with finding equity there.
Well, and I appreciate your concern, Justice Tatum, but my feeling on it is that we're not necessarily expanding the rule. Because what happened in Copeland, again, I'm going to go back to that, is we had this employment discrimination claim, and the plaintiff there went to the Nevada Equal Rights Commission and said, I want to file some paperwork with you guys, which, as we know, under the statute, means the statute would have been told. Okay? That didn't happen for one reason or another. Someone at the NERC didn't do what they were supposed to do. The plaintiff
in Copeland, was he or she misled by the agency?
I don't know that they were necessarily willfully misled. I think it may have been a negligent mistake of the agency, but it was the agency's fault that it happened the way that decision reads. So she missed the statute of limitations, and this court said, the statute, nonetheless, these anti-discrimination statutes have laudable goals. We want to further those goals, and we don't want this procedural technicality to trip someone up. Here, now granted, my client didn't go to the NERC, but what my client did was he went to the federal court thinking this was the solution, and his 1983 complaint gets stuck in a screening process, presumably under the Prison Litigation Reform Act. And with all due respect, I love our federal courts out here. Judge Dorsey's, you know, worked for my firm. She's one of my great friends. But they work very slowly out there. And he realized when he got to October of 2012 that he was not going to be able to pursue his claims in federal court. And once that came about, he very rapidly changed and dismissed the complaint in federal court and then came to state court. This was certainly a procedural trap for the unwary, if you will. It was something that happened to my client because of his lack of knowledge. And I think that falls squarely within the facts of Copeland, Judge Seda, because like the NERC either willfully or unintentionally misrepresenting, my client did not understand the screening process in federal court, and now he should not lose his civil rights claim simply because he was not informed. That is not what our access to justice public policy should be about in Nevada, and I think that's why Justice Hardesty cited Waters versus Young in the Milam opinion, and I urge the court to look at that. I see that I'm running out of time, so if there are any further questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. We have 3 minutes and 6 seconds remaining.
Thank you.
Mr. Jones.
Thank you. Please, the court. I would like to start with a little bit more of the actual factual background of the case. As we know, the case was filed in state court by Mr. Woods in December of 2012. It alleged three causes of action. One was extreme and outrageous conduct. The second was intimidation, and the third was racial discrimination. Now, admittedly, it was rather inartfully drafted, but it was filed on December 12, 2012, and when it was served, finally, upon Kings Row, of course, I filed a motion to dismiss. And the first basis was that it failed to state the day, the month, or even the year when any of these so-called actions, conduct, took place. I think I would have been derelict if I had not. We have such clear rules in Nevada, even against pro se litigants. You can't just file something and make broad allegations. So I moved to dismiss on the grounds that he didn't state the date when any of these acts occurred. And he didn't. And the second basis was, the second claim was in.
When you're late, do you get a requirement that you need to state the date that a tort occurred?
Oh, for defamation, for example?
No, for intentional infliction.
Well, for any claim, you have to state the date, I would argue. I would argue that you can't just come into court and not state when these alleged actions occurred. How does one defend? I filed a simple motion to dismiss, giving the defendant, the plaintiff, the opportunity to come in and state when they happen so that we can investigate and do that. The third was racial discrimination. This clearly was the same identical claim that was brought in federal court, even references to Kings Row, It was a public accommodation. And I would just backtrack for a minute. Mr. Woods was in federal court until October of 2012. He was in federal court from June of 2011 until October of 2012 when he voluntarily dismissed his civil rights actions. He was allowed by the federal court to amend and did amend those claims several times. Now, the suggestion is, well, he didn't realize, you know, he didn't realize, he didn't understand, but the federal statutes that he cited have the same public accommodation claims that we have in Nevada. They're identical. In fact, we patterned them after the federal rules and set a 1-year statute of limitations. So it's, I think it's disingenuous.
So if he'd stayed in federal court, his
public accommodation allegations,
those would have been still timely, and he would have been able to proceed under federal law, is what you're saying?
Exactly. There's no question about it.
Okay.
No question about it. He understood. Yes, he amended several times.
So the complaint was valid to state a claim in federal court, is your point? Did it allege the date?
He made various allegations of dates, but that could have been addressed. The problem was he never served Kings Row or Mr. Steele. 17 months that case was in federal court, and my client knew nothing, absolutely nothing about it. We found out about it when he filed his declarations in opposition to our motion to dismiss in state court. Then I went back, I pulled up the records, and discovered for the first time that this case had been pending for a year and a half, and it was a public accommodation claim against Kings Row and Mr. Steele in his managerial capacity. But what, I'm diverting myself a bit, but I want to get back to the motion to dismiss. The second was clearly a defamation. It was clearly defamation claims made. When you make incendiary racial assertions out of the mouth of someone else and base your claims upon that for racial discrimination, which he did, you know, a person is entitled to know in order to respond to that when the defamation occurred. I think I pointed out some in Blackstone, some case that goes back to the 1200s. In fact, a little further research shows that the 12 tables in Roman law, which were written hundreds of years before Justinian's Institutes, that was one of the requirements. You've got to publicly state these allegations in order to have a cause of action. So we asked for the particulars. And he filed a couple of declarations. But the long and the short of it is, one of the assertions occurred with Rick the handyman in March 23rd of 2010. He filed the state court action in December of 2012. Now, according to my calculations, that claim, any assertions related to that claim, had long since expired. And the filing of a federal claim, well, it may toll a discrimination claim, sure, if it's done properly, just like filing with NERC. But it certainly doesn't toll the statute of limitations applicable to an assertion of that nature.
So are you conceding that the filing of the federal claim told the discrimination claim?
I wouldn't want to give that impression. I'm just saying that even if.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, he voluntarily dismissed it. And it's very clear that he, after filing a public accommodation claim, he did voluntarily dismiss all of the racial discrimination claims. And I would point out that the federal court, when they give you the forms to fill out, asks you specifically to identify the statutes, the times, the places, the individuals, and he was given every opportunity. So I can't fault the federal court.
So Mr. James, then Copeland is of no value to this particular case, as Mr. Carter suggests it might be?
My point is that if he's suggesting that the federal court somehow or other screwed him up in his pleadings, I think that's really ridiculous. But Copeland, this is a case against defendants, and the defendant is Kings Row. And if you're going to get around, that was a workman's comp case. If you're going to get around Copeland, you're going to have to show, number four, any deception or false assurances on the part of the employer against whom the claim is made and the prejudice that would result to the employer. In this case, kids know nothing about the federal lawsuit. They did nothing to impede or hinder his ability to pursue his claims. They didn't even get served. So that, number four of Copeland, has to be met. You've got to show that the employer, in this case, Kings Row, did something to prejudice your rights. They did nothing. They didn't even know the lawsuit was filed until they were finally served in federal or in state court. My point is the statute of limitations, let me put it this way. Mr. Woods has never satisfactorily explained how he's going to get around the statute of limitations applicable to a defamation claim or this outrageous conduct, intentional infliction of emotional distress.
He alleges a June of 2011 incident where, if you credit it as true, and that's our obligation at the pleading stage, I mean, I don't know what's true or not true, but he claims that he was accosted at your client's facility and accused of being a thief, and other epithets were used. Okay. And that claim,
okay,
he's asserting it as defamatory and as intentional infliction of emotional distress. So why wouldn't those claims be allowed to proceed?
Then I go back to the heart of my motion to dismiss, which was, were these statements published to any third person? He's had opportunity after opportunity, not only in federal court, but in his declarations, to show that they were published to any third person. He's never done it.
Wouldn't that be more of a summary judgment after discovery kind of?
No, I would argue that he's got to allege that in the complaint. He's got to meet that burden in opposition to a motion to dismiss. Otherwise, every lawsuit, all you have to do is say, well, we met on the corner and he called me this and that. I filed a lawsuit, and we get to go through 2 or 3 years of litigation before you can file a motion for summary judgment and have it dismissed.
Mr. Jones, my concern is I just reread the order from Judge Baer. It looks to me like it's a dismissal with prejudice because he cites the one-year statute of limitations. But if the statute of limitations was 2 years on defamation and intentional infliction of emotional distress, would that be legal error by the judge? Because if it is, he would have had to dismiss those claims without prejudice versus with prejudice.
I can't speak for the judge. I know that we argued vigorously that he had not made the allegations of publication that would relate to the defamation claim, and he clearly didn't, and he still hasn't.
But so that would be a dismissal without prejudice, is my point. If it's a pleading failure, it's not a dismissal with prejudice. If it's statute of limitations, it is with prejudice, and this order looks like it's all based on the statute of limitations.
And it was based upon the one-year statute of limitations. Even those issues were raised, so then I guess I would ask this court to look behind it and see if he's ever met that burden and what would be the purpose of sending it back, since he hasn't, nor can he, in my view.
Your point is it's futile.
It's futile. It's futile. So I believe that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Mr. Carter. At least for my part, Mr. Carter, you're going to have to talk to me about the points that seem to be distinguishable in your case from Copeland.
Yes, Your Honor. And I would like to point out that I believe Mr. Johns had Copeland confused with Sano. Sano was a workers' comp case. Copeland was, in fact, an anti-discrimination case based on disability.
The filing was before the Equal Rights Commission.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I believe, please correct me if I'm wrong, I think that your question is going to go specifically to the six-factor test from Copeland and how we fit into that.
Precisely.
Now, I don't pretend, Your Honor, into this court, that every single factor from Copeland is a precise fit for this case. However, I don't think that Copeland required all of its factors to be met in every single case. But let's start looking at those. The first one is the diligence of the claimant. We have to ask ourselves, how diligent was my client? Again, the cause of action accrues in February of 2011. He files a federal complaint in June of 2011. While we're going through the Prisoner Litigation Reform Act screening process, all the way up into 2012, he tries amending his complaint a few times. He's not getting anywhere. Then he dismisses. And then less than 2 months later, he files his complaint in state court. That is very diligent, particularly on behalf of a client who is who's incarcerated and has very limited mobility. He was very much on top of this, Your Honor.
Well, what happened, Mr. Carter, to the federal complaint? I mean, is it still pending or what?
It is not, Your Honor. My client voluntarily dismissed that.
Did he do it before he filed the state court?
Yes, he did, Your Honor. And one of the reasons that he gave for that was he believed he needed to pursue his claims in state court.
I guess Mr. Johns is arguing that there's prejudice to his clients because of this delay in federal court and maybe he didn't know what he was doing, but here Mr. Johns had to go dig out this federal court case, and that's how he found out about it. Why wouldn't that be prejudicial to Mr. Johns' clients?
A couple of reasons for that, Your Honor. When a client is a litigant is pursuing a claim in forma pauperis, as Mr. Woods was, he obviously cannot serve complaints and pleadings himself, and he can't hire someone to do this. It's generally the court that does it. My understanding under the Prison Litigation Reform Act is that's something that the court will only do once it's done with its screening process. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's like a motion to dismiss that's brought sua sponte by the court. So that's the first reason there's no prejudice. The second reason I'd say there's no prejudice to the respondents here is, as a matter of law, we should be litigating the intentional infliction of emotional distress and defamation claims right now. I think, as you pointed out, Justice Gibbons, it was an error of law for the court to dismiss the defamation claim when the statute had yet to run, to dismiss with prejudice. King Roe should be in court litigating this right now. What is the prejudice of litigating the extra civil rights claim? And we've mixed up the factors a little bit, Justice Seda, but I definitely want to go through those. The second factor from Copeland is the claimant's knowledge of the relevant facts. And again, this is not quite the same as in Copeland, where you had someone who believed she'd gone to the NERC and had a complaint being filed. Here, my client had gone to the federal court, and he believed his complaint was going forward. And although he was diligent and he was trying to get it moving, he didn't have a real good insight into that. So I think that weighs in my client's favor. The third factor from Copeland is the claimant's reliance on misstatements by an agency. Again, there wasn't an agency here, and I don't think the district court was making misstatements to him, so I don't think this really goes either way. The fourth factor is deception or false assurances. Again, I don't think that really applies in this case. Fifth is prejudice to the defendant.
You concede there was no deception or false assurances?
No, there were no deception or false. The federal court did not lie to my client, and I don't maintain that, apart from the tortious behavior that underlies.
His client didn't lie to you either.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The other equitable considerations, which is the sixth factor to be considered under Copeland, I think the court really has to take a hard look at this under the Ninth Circuit decisions. We talked about Waters versus Young, and in the brief we have Wilhelm versus Rotman, and the Lerner case, which is from the Second Circuit, all of which go back to the Supreme Court in Hughes versus Roe, which talked about how prisoner complaints generally are held to a much lesser standard of review. I see my time has expired. On that, I would ask the court to reverse unless the court has any further questions.
No questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Carter, Mr. John, for your briefs. Your arguments here today, the matter will stand submitted. And we'll allow time for the next case to come forward.